Welcome to Plymouth Beneath the Surface podcast. Take a deep breath and dive with me into Plymouth waters to meet people such as scientists, students, photographers, divers, and artists that have orientated their lives around the ocean. I'm your host, Louisa Sien, a recent marine biology graduate from the University of Plymouth, and I'm really happy to have you here to listen to some of my conversations with inspiring and passionate people talking about the ocean. So let's get started. Well, welcome to this new episode. I'm with John Spicer. Welcome, John.
It's nice to be here.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
Okay, I can try. I'm John Spicer, originally from Glasgow. I'm Professor of Marine Biology here in Plymouth and have been in Plymouth for 21 years.
Cool. So what do you do? I know it's a big question.
What do I do? You mean as in academically or real life?
Related to marine biology.
Related to marine biology. I'm really fortunate in as much as my job is what I've always wanted to do, and that is to teach people to think and to research and teach marine biology and biology in all its fullness, you know, because, I mean, there is no such thing as marine biology. There's just the biology of marine things. So that's what I get to do. I get to do what I've always wanted to do, to teach people to think and to research and teach marine biology, biology generally. That's it.
What's your career path?
Yeah, I sat in a small rock on a small Scottish island called the Isle of Cumbria, where Glasgow people go on holiday for 2 weeks. And I was sitting on this rock because my mum dumped me there because she realised I was really quiet and really very well behaved on this rock in the middle of a rock pool. And she could go on with things. And the reason I was so well behaved was because all round about me were all these just amazing little creatures. You know, I saw a little shrimp crawl out of the rock pool and walk. And I thought, wow, I wonder how you do that. You know, if you're a shrimp, how do you walk? You know, I can see swim, but walk. And picking a sea urchin up and looked at that, and all of a sudden its backside's on top of its head. And I'd seen this thing, I thought it was vomiting at first because stuff was coming out of its top. And I thought, why is it vomiting out of its mouth? That's its backside. Yeah, well, why would you put your backside on top and do that? And so as a kid, I just loved asking questions. I didn't realise I could do it as a career. I thought it was just part of me. School in Glasgow was great. I had very, very good teachers. I had no idea what a university was, never mind you could go to it. I didn't know marine biology was a subject. I just loved marine stuff. And Mrs. Rogers in primary 7, she talked to me a lot about going to this school in town where I could get qualifications to do science and everything else. And that was fantastic. I mean, really, just the difference it makes having a great teacher who really looks out for you and cares for you. Went to this school in the middle of town, which was a specialised science engineering school. I must confess, went a little bit, didn't go off biology, but I discovered rock and roll and other other distractions. That was interesting for a time, but still managed to just get through school. Forgot a little bit about marine biology, but it was always there. But again, I just wasn't sure that, you know, as someone from Glasgow who lives next to the shipyards, are they allowed to do stuff like that? So I managed to get a place at University of Glasgow doing zoology. They didn't do marine biology. And I thought, well, it's the closest thing to it. I didn't really enjoy a lot of my time at Glasgow. In fact, as soon as I finished, I actually got a job in Littlewoods as a manager, deciding that the experience I'd had at university was maybe not something I would want to pursue as a career. So I thought, do something worthwhile, be a manager. I was also thinking of being a sort of social worker and youth worker at the time. But my old supervisor, my old project supervisor, one of the people who'd been really good at Glasgow, he came into the shop with his wife and he said, look, I've got a position coming up. I know that you're heading away from this sort of stuff, but I would really love if you would take this position, because we got on really well and he liked the way that I'd done my science. So I thought, well, maybe, okay, do that. So I got this position and I did a PhD at the same time, but I did a PhD in something which is different from during the day. So I had my day job working for Alan Taylor, looking at how prawns coped with low oxygen environments and how different species did different things. That was the day job. But at night, I went back to that little story of, you know, the shrimp coming out of the water. I'd always wanted to know, how do you do that for a shrimp? So I did my PhD on how shrimps live on land.
At the same time
as I was really fortunate that both sets of work went very, very well. And by the end of that, I thought, yeah, I love this. This is great. I could do this. And that was when I really decided I was going to stick with it. 1990, after I'd done a postdoc in Canada, which was fantastic, in the West Coast, Vancouver Island, amazing place, almost as beautiful as Scotland, almost as much rich wildlife as Scotland. And that was amazing. And we went to Denmark for a time as well, and I worked with some very, very fine people there. But I had this thing, and it's strange, I don't know if you get it or a lot of the people who'll be listening have gone through something like this, where you think to yourself, this is really good. But it seems to be almost too much about me. You know, it's my dream, what I want to do. And Fiona, my wife and I, we've always had this thing about, how do you do something that's really useful? And I thought, well, is it really useful doing marine biology? There's other things that I could do. At that point, my mum took seriously ill in Glasgow, and we knew she was going to die. So I left the position in Denmark, and we came back to Glasgow with no job, essentially, just so that she could have the children round about her. And as it turned out, she died within weeks of us getting back. So I just left the job. So I thought, well, let's do something useful then. So I trained as a primary and secondary school teacher and social worker. Got a job, was about to start, when my academic colleagues from Canada and from Denmark said, we've applied for a job for you.
They applied for you in your name.
Yeah, we don't think you should leave science. We would love you to go for this job interview. When friends do that for you, you have to think, well, maybe. Because I had made up my mind, right, okay, teaching in a school and the social work side of that position was already lined up. But I went, got the job, University of Sheffield. I was there for 10 years before I came to Plymouth. So it's been a bit of a torturous path in some ways. But I think I realised when I went for the Sheffield job that it wasn't just about me. Academia didn't have to just be about me. And the stuff that I experienced at Glasgow, where some of the folk there didn't see students as an essential part of the university. And I wanted to be part of a university and contribute to a university where I could actually teach and educate people. And all the stuff that I would have loved at university, to try and make sure that the people who come get those opportunities. So that was my way of ensuring it wasn't just about me, at least in my own mind.
Now, do you find that you're doing something that is useful? And are you having an impact?
In 2006, I had a couple of heart attacks and ended up in a hospital. Basically, was told to put my house in order. And I remember the night after that, lying wondering, so am I going to wake up? You know? And it's quite salutary going through and thinking, so what have I done? What's it been worth? I thought of all the stuff that I'd done. But actually, what made the difference and what I thought, yeah, this is good, was Fiona, my beautiful wife, my kids and my friends, and all the students I've taught. Papers, I've got 200 scientific papers. Great, I'm really proud of it, but it's not what it's about. I've got, I don't know how many books. I've got a number of books, really proud of them, it's great. That's not what it's about. I get people telling me how wonderful bits of my science are. That's really lovely, and I wouldn't want to denigrate it. I'm just so pleased, but it's the students, it's the people.
That makes me feel emotional because obviously I've just graduated and you have been one of these really inspiring people in first year, like going through your lectures. So I think you've ticked that box.
Thank you. It's good to hear.
Let's talk about one of your book because I know the last edition
is out. Yeah.
Is out.
Yeah, yeah.
Your last edition is out. It's Biodiversity, about biodiversity.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, what is biodiversity?
All right, easy.
Because we talk about it so much, but actually, it's really hard to define, isn't it?
That's why I wrote the book, to be honest, because it was my way of finding out what I meant by biodiversity. And in the second edition, I actually put in the preface that you can't write the definitive book on biodiversity. You can write a book which is about biodiversity, and it'll be different for each person. For me, I still stick with that great definition that's in the Convention for Biological Diversity, which is the only thing we've got worldwide to help us look after our world. And it's essentially the manifestation of life in all its forms and its interactions with everything else. So, yeah, biodiversity is everything. You know, it's not just a biological subject. It really is the milieu that we live in its widest context. I mean, it's impossible to define. There's 94 different definitions. There's probably more than that now. Someone else has probably been upset with the 94 and gone on to 95 or 96. But it's the manifestation of life. Now, don't ask me to define life in all its different variety and forms and everything else and our interactions. So there's no field of human endeavour that it doesn't cover, actually.
What are the big challenges facing global biodiversity?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, where people are beginning to catch on to climate change. And certainly climate change is affecting lots of things, and not least biodiversity. But a report that was done 2 years ago, that they tried to put into order the things that were really threatening biodiversity. Climate change comes third. Now, it was interesting, some right-wing US folk caught on to the fact that I'd pointed this out and were saying, there, yeah, we told you it wasn't important. Saying, well, actually,
it's not what I meant.
It's not quite the way it is. It's third, which gives you an idea of just how pressing the other two things are. And certainly destruction of habitat, destruction and degradation of habitat and over-exploitation. I wouldn't say that they totally leave climate change behind as a threat, but they really are urgent, and just as urgent as climate change. If you tackle climate change on its own, assuming that we actually managed to get our act together in time to do that, what sort of world are we going to live in? Life can exist, and life will exist on this lovely planet of ours. We're dead and gone. And so the people who say that they want to save, you know, life, but biodiversity is about saving wildlife, I would say that actually the question's about, what sort of world do you really want to live in? What sort of world do you want your children to live in? Because it will be a radically different one, even if we solve the climate change crisis. If that such a thing was possible, I don't believe it is, it's intimately related. But the over-exploitation, what we take out of the natural world, what we actually remove from its context and everything that that means, 7.7 billion people doing that in a way which is much more energy intensive than before. Each person on the planet uses far more now per person than it's ever done in the past. This is literally unsustainable. And the degradation of habitat, the way, I mean, we've even managed to destroy deserts. So, you know, I mean, it'd be funny if it wasn't true. We've actually degraded areas of desert, nowhere on Earth untouched. And so we are committing this huge experiment, not doing a huge experiment, I say committing this huge experiment on the stuff that keeps us alive. So for those who think that, you know, biodiversity, yeah, I suppose if you're interested in wildlife or doing marine biology, it's fine. I would say, if you're quite interested in what life looks like for you and for your children and your neighbours and anyone else, biodiversity degradation and destruction and exploitation will change your life. And in ways that you really perhaps don't want to see, particularly for your children.
So if we apply this to the ocean, I guess overexploitation will be probably fishing.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of overexploitation, I suppose if you pay a bit attention to the coastal regions, then that interaction with land and sea, it's not just about fishing, it's about the degradation of those areas, which you have a lot of material which basically feeds into the food webs that are there. We used to think of food chains. It's quite nice to think of a food chain. That eats that, which eats that, which eats that. That's quite easy. Of course, it's not like that. It's like a ball of string with all the bits cut and all linked together. But if you take one bit of that out, there has to be a restructuring of apps, everything. It's colossal. You know, so you don't just lose one species. You lose the way a whole ecosystem is organised, just in the loss or degradation of one species. And I don't think we've quite got our head around the magnitude of that, simply because, I mean, even modelling that, you know? I mean, we find it difficult to model the outcomes. One of the best examples that I saw was with the Peruvian anchovy, where it was fished out completely about 50 years ago. And you look at all the things that were related to the anchovy, including human beings, and you take it out of the picture and try to work out where all the different bits go after that. It's heuristically interesting. Wow, that's quite cool. And then you sit and think, right, but it'll change the way the ocean works. And you don't know how you've done it or what you've done. You don't even know if the timescale you're looking at is the right timescale. And the beauty of the ocean is you can't see any of it, so really easy to forget, even for marine biologists.
Yeah. And it's really hard to imagine, or like it's not common knowledge that, you know, everything isn't linked, humans included, and that we rely on it so much.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably one of the roots of the problem is that we see ourselves completely separated from the rest.
It's interesting. A friend of mine once wrote a book about this, you know, looking back into history, the civilizations that have been biodiversity friendly versus those that have not been biodiversity friendly because of their beliefs or practices. And what he argued was that actually there was no real golden age. The fact is that when you've got 7.7 billion people, no matter what they believe, they have a massive impact. And a lot of the sustainability practices which come from people, you know, sort of living in harmony with nature, they could do it because there was very few of them. If you look at what you would class as biodiversity-friendly worldviews, biodiversity-unfriendly worldviews, and put them on to countries and the world, it doesn't seem to affect our actions very much.
So do you reckon the problem is that we are too many? And even if we were trying to, you know, live sustainably, whatever that means, try to use resources more efficiently or in a way that can allow them to recover, because we're too many, it wouldn't make a difference?
Perhaps I've given the wrong impression there. It's the too many, but as I said earlier on, it's what those people are doing, you know, it's the key thing. There's enough food on Earth for everyone, and even although one third of the world starves, the biodiversity works fairly well, even for the 7.7 billion of us, until we start just being really, really greedy. So it's, I wouldn't say that population number on its own is the key thing. It's what those numbers do. The personal, individual choices. I mean, there are huge global corporations which are doing things which are not the best. But the fate of biodiversity depends on individual decisions of 7.7 billion people.
And how do you make these people to make the right decisions?
A guy called Flesness in 1992 said there is no precedent for making, at the time, 6 billion people have an enlightened view of the future, which was a very, very negative way of looking at things. The first edition of the biodiversity book that I published, I must confess at the end of it, I felt fairly deflated because I felt that comment, Flesness's comment, there's no precedent for 7.7 billion people sharing an enlightened view of the future. I feel a change. I don't know if you've ever been out in the forest trying to get a small fire going. It's almost impossible, particularly if it's been wet. Then you get it going and you think, is it going to keep going or is it going to go out? I think that's the stage that I'm at in my mind. Super, super impressed by the young people who are actually just saying, actually, you're not doing this to my future, you know? I mean, Greta is one example of lots of people who are out there who are not just saying, but trying to live a considered life and trying to get the rest of us to do it. That's new and that feels quite good. The big thing was, just before we had this COVID pandemic, there was a biodiversity report which said, we need transformative change. And everyone agrees, yeah, of course we do. But come on, realistic, can we really do transformative change? Then COVID came. I mean, if you want to see if transformative change is possible, we've seen that it is. It's not a pipe dream anymore. It's not something you can say, oh, well, it's an awful lot to change. Our whole existence has changed in the last year and a half. So we can do it. So then the question is, do you want to do this? Not can we do it? Do you want to do this? And I think that's what the voices that I hear, mainly young voices, are saying just now. Do you want to do this? Because it doesn't look like it. Those voices were not as loud back in 2006. So the second biodiversity book has certainly got a different feel to it because of that. If you're clever, you'll realise I haven't quite answered your question. I've sort of come round at the back of it. What's going to make the difference? There is a growing awareness. Whether we'll make that final jump and whether we do it soon enough, I still think is in the balance, but I think there is hope now. And I didn't quite have as much hope 10, 15 years ago.
Is it through education? Is it through knowledge? Is it through emotions? I know it's not one single thing, but how can people shift their perception of the future? What is going to be that moment where they're going to be like, yes, I actually want to do it?
I don't think there is a magic bullet. I think there'll be lots of magic bullets. And I think it's for each of us to look and see, you know, where we contribute. I mean, one of the things that I delight in is a lot of church and religious groups will ask me to go and talk on their faith and the biodiversity crisis. It's still a small number compared to all the churches that are in the world. I mean, many of them don't seem to have caught on to this, but some of them have caught on to the fact that although they've been portrayed as having a biodiversity unfriendly worldview, domination of nature, some of them are catching on to the fact, Islam, Judaism and Christianity, that in fact it's stewardship that's at the centre, not domination, and are wanting to respond to that. And there are 2 billion Catholics in the world, 2 out of 7.7 billion people. What happens if the Catholic Church took their faith seriously? All of a sudden, you don't need that many people to be a major game changer. And that sort of both excites me and depresses me at the same time, if I'm honest. There are groups of people with faith who are responding to this. It's interesting that Ed Wilson, a few years ago, he published a letter to his Southern Baptist pastor. Right now, Ed's an atheist. But why did he publish this letter to his Southern Baptist pastor? And when you read it, it's peculiar and it's wonderful and it's perplexing. Because what he seems to be saying is, I've tried as an atheist and I just don't seem to be able to do anything. Whereas you folk, you seem to think that God is creator and that he cares about this stuff. You've got the perfect ethic. And then he writes, I can't remember the exact wording, but he writes something like, so we really need you in your faith. From someone who is a confirmed atheist to say that, maybe there's something there. So, I mean, part of my thing is trying to get people of faith to realise that their faith is intimately linked with biodiversity. It's not some side issue. And certainly what's happened in the States with the Trump era, where basically we've seen the complete opposite of that, doesn't give much room for hope. Except that's just one small section of people. I was really surprised when I was brought up in a part of Glasgow which had no real truck with religion. It was just lots of trouble, to be honest. I was really surprised when the Pope comes out with a biodiversity book 5 or 6 years ago, De Laudidium, and it's amazing. It's really, really good. It didn't seem to make much of an impact in this country from what I can see, but in a lot of the poorer parts of the world, the young people have caught on to it and are part of action for biodiversity. And you're the people that are suffering most just now, so I suppose maybe not too surprising. So I think that's just one example. I think each of us have to look and see, where is it that I can contribute, make an impact? There is no golden bullet. Everyone is not going to turn around. There is no precedent for 7.7 billion people saying, oh yeah, let's do this. But there might be lots of wee bits and pieces. That's the part that I suppose... That and giving those lectures, the biodiversity lectures in first year. The reason I do choose to do that, is just to try and shake up the wrong word, engage. And so I do think there's an education side to it as well. So it's, for me, those are the things that I feel called to. And I wouldn't want to say that everyone has to do that. I think each of us have to find what we can do, what we've been given the gifts to do and the opportunity to do, and do it.
We usually, I think, maybe not now, but probably still, young people, when we, you know, think about biodiversity and the threats, I think, yeah, now maybe climate change is a big thing. But at least when I came to uni, I thought, you know, maybe plastic pollution was quite a big thing. I mean, it is a big thing, but yeah, I thought it was like one of the biggest threats to marine biodiversity, and having all your lectures on each of like, you know, overexploitation, habitat destruction, climate change. I've got to say, it was a bit depressing. Yeah. I think you've got 6 lectures or something, and the 5 first ones were pretty depressing, and then the last one was sort of filled with hope and, you know, what we can do. And I think it's really empowering, and maybe you need to go through that sort of depression state, or like it's being down to earth and actually, you know, looking at the problem and facing what's going on, to then being able to take action. So I think it is like a phase that you need to go through before you can actually feel like, now I want to do something. And I remember at the end, everyone was applauding and pretty crying. Crying not from being sad, but crying from feeling really hopeful. And it's, yeah, thinking about what you do, and especially as a first year starting uni and being like, okay, I'm on this journey now. How am I going to use that degree, and how am I contributing to, and how? I think it's giving that opportunity to every single student to think about what they do and how they can make a difference.
It doesn't have to be everyone who decides to make a difference. You need a comparatively small number of people to change the way they do things before societies change. You know, I mean, there's people even worked out what the numbers are, all the accountants and things. Each year since I've come to Plymouth, 21 years, 200 students in each class. That could make a huge difference.
The thing is, it's easy to think that what you do is not going to make a difference, especially when, you know, you want politicians and big corporates to actually change. I know it's a big question, but how do you make these people that actually take decisions and make the laws and everything, how do you make them realize how important biodiversity is, or how we need to protect the living world and that it's now?
See, I think there's two things in there for me anyway. And one is this idea of living a considered life. I mean, that goes back to Aristotle. I mean, we're not talking about sort of some modern day theory. When was living a considered life not a good thing to do? Before we had an energy crisis, when was it ever a good idea just to leave all the lights in your house on? When was it a good idea just to have electrical appliances just going and wasting stuff? When was that ever acceptable? Now, I mean, it was, because people just didn't think. So I would say that the challenge for me, the challenge for you and for each individual person is, are you living a considered life? First and foremost, are you considering the way that you live? And I don't necessarily mean by that going for all the trendy stuff, but just think about what you do day by day, what you value and how you react to things. Are you living a considered life? That in itself, I think, is a major step forward, leaving all the politics and everything else aside, because without that, there's no base. Political change is great. I mean, we've got rid of racism in this country, haven't we? You know, we've changed the law. A human heart is a bit harder to change. Whereas that considered life, that's changing yourself, something you can do. In terms of the politics, some people have just got a real gift for that. They're born campaigners, and we need to empower and help them as much as possible. But it's not for everyone to be a sort of political agitator fixing policy, because I think you have to be good at it. I think you have to be really good at it. If you're good at it, then you should be encouraged, and we should encourage people who are good at it. So for me, that, believe it or not, that individual thing, it's individuals that change the world. I mean, Microsoft might want to think that they do, but it's actually individuals. Even within Microsoft, it's individuals.
But even, yeah, exactly, with like big corporations, they're made of individuals. So how do we want the big corporations to change if the individuals that work in there, take the decisions, don't change on a basic fundamental level in their individual personal life as well before they make a change on it?
So encourage everyone to live and get them to ask questions. It's hard enough to do it with yourself, but once you start doing it, it's really quite refreshing asking questions about what you believe, why you believe that. Where did that come from? Does that work? Am I consistent with that? And I don't mean a sort of, well, you're spending every day peering up your own belly wondering what's going on and oh, woe to me is, but just a genuinely considered, why do I think what I do? Where does that come from? Something that's just I've adopted and I've forgotten about? Is it something I really believe in? If I believe in it, what am I doing? What should I do? It's quite a liberating thing. It doesn't have to be a sort of wear barbed wire knickers type thing.
Exactly. That's also the other thing. Like, you also want to have a happy life and not constantly think about the impact that you have, because otherwise you stop doing most things that you do. It's finding this good balance between I'm trying my best, I'm trying hard, but equally I'm still joyful, I'm still being happy.
Yeah, I mean, for one of the things I've learned from friends in countries which are difficult to live in is that there are things that are worse than dying, and having something to live for is really, really important. You know, and yeah, if you let all this stuff get you down to such an extent you can't do anything, then you're part of the problem, not the solution. I must confess, I do go through waves. You know, I mean, like what's been happening in Germany with these floods, I mean, it wasn't totally unexpected. It's partly physics, isn't it? The air is warming up, it carries more moisture. You know, I mean, it's not rocket science. So it is that desire to think and to change.
It brings me back to first year. I really like having that conversation with you.
And you realise I'm no expert in this. I mean, no one could be an expert in biodiversity. And also, even the things I'm saying about considered life, this is just John Spicer talking as an individual. But if other people will do the same, having considered where they are and what they're doing, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Look at Greta. It's just, who would have thought a wee girl sitting outside with a poster with a school strike and that picture of her on her own doing it? And you think, well, where's that going to go? Where's that going to go?
It's easy to... I remember talking to a friend and being like, I don't feel legitimate to do that. And he's like, do you think Greta was feeling legitimate when she was outside striking? Like, you don't need to feel legitimate. If it feels right, then just do it. It's really empowering as well. I don't really know if I should ask about my marine organisms now.
But they're important. Do you remember, oh no, you didn't do the first year field course with me. We used John Steinbeck's book, which is to deal with exactly the issue that you're having just now. You know, I go into a tide pool and I take out a little coral. And that's not important to the economy of the tide pool. You know, great fishing boats are coming and taking, destroying fish along the coast of the States. But, you know, in some ways, that's not really that important. There's a huge war going on. Millions being killed, but the stars aren't moved. Either all of it's important or none of it's important. Mm. So yeah, your wee questions are just as important as those big ones, which is great, isn't it? And it's really liberating. Either all of it's important or none of it's important. Mm. I'll go for the all of it.
And where can we find your book?
I mean, you can get it straight from One World Books. I mean, you can get it from any bookseller. I mean, it's on sale everywhere from what I can see. I really enjoyed writing it. It sounds a strange thing to say, but I find writing really hard, and I've always found it hard, which is why I enjoy teaching students to write, because I know how difficult it is. And I still have things come back, just red marks on them. Oh, it's just, you know, even after doing so much. But this time I revised the book, but I actually rewrote it. I found I couldn't just revise it. And I really love doing it, because I think I actually managed to put into words what I'd always wanted to put into words, which I can't always say, to be honest. And it doesn't read quite as badly as the first one. Sorry, I shouldn't admit that. But
how different is it from the first one? Apart from, like you said, you rewrote it.
Everything's updated. But also, because my son now lives in California and San Diego, and I love that part of the world. And for marine biologists, it's an incredible part of the world. So the first book had based around Wembley here and based in the UK. But I wanted the challenge of putting it in San Diego and that beautiful Mission Beach where he is. And of course, you've got La Jolla Scripps Marine Institute just up the road. And I just wanted to pick that as a bit of a centre just for a change. And also some of the views in it are different.
So you've updated it with numbers as well?
Yeah, it's completely updated. Of course, it was handed to the publishers in November last year when we were just in the pandemic. So there's a lot of, you know, well, this trend is going up. Hey, but there's a pandemic on, so you better wait and see. It's the first thing I've written, which I think I can quietly say I'm really pleased with.
Cool. Well, amazing. Thank you, John, for this lovely conversation. And even if we didn't go really into your details of some of the studies you've done, I think
another time. We can talk about Antarctica another time.
That'd be cool. Well, thank you, John.
No, at all. You're welcome.
This episode didn't really go as planned because when I decided to do an episode with John Spicer, I really wanted to talk about biodiversity, obviously to talk about his book, but I was going to ask more questions about, you know, the effects of climate change on marine organisms and the effect of low oxygen or temperature, basically what John Spicer has been researching for the last years and for most of his career. But as you may have listened, it went on a tangent and we actually talked about biodiversity and how we can actually change at a really individual level, and I think it went on a sort of philosophical tangent, but it was really inspiring and I loved every single minute of this interview, and I hope you did, and I hope you enjoyed listening to John Spicer, and I am so happy to finish the podcast with him. So for those that don't know, this is the final episode of the series with myself. And I'm really happy to be finishing with John because he was one of the first person I met in Plymouth at university, and that really inspired me. So finishing with him means quite a lot to me. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed this episode and I hope you enjoyed every single episode of this series. And if that's the first one that you're listening to, well, there are 13 other episodes that you can listen to. Thanks everyone for having been part of this journey with me. I hope you see why Plymouth is such a great place for marine biology. I love my time here. I had an amazing time and I'm so grateful for all the people that were around me and that just inspired me, taught me, and people I spend time with. And Plymouth has a really special place in my heart. And this podcast has definitely been part of the adventure and of the journey. So thanks for having shared a bit of this with me. And obviously, keep in touch.